You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero-trust-AI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast. From the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, the museum brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence. We're joined today by Hank Parker, who holds a PhD in biological oceanography and is an adjunct professor at Georgetown University School of Medicine, where he teaches a course on biological threats to food and agriculture. He formerly served as a senior executive and acting director of Homeland Security for the Agricultural Research Service of USDA, and has published and lectured on bio and agroterrorism. He is the author of the new novel Containment, a bioterrorism thriller, which just came out last week. So thank you, Hank, for joining us here on Spycast.
Thank you.
So we don't have a lot of fiction authors on Spycast, and when we do, they're usually ex-spooks who have just written some new kind of spy novel. However, the topic of your book is something that has interest to me, and perhaps the right word isn't interest, it's more of something that frightens me for a long time. And perhaps, in my mind, it only qualifies as a novel because something like it hasn't happened yet. Is bioterrorism something that keeps you up at night? Is that why you decided to write a book like this about it?
Yeah. In fact, I think it should keep us all up at night. I got into this. I mean, obviously, with a background in biological oceanography, there's not a whole lot of biological threats under the seas. But I sort of went from that and teaching at a university to working for USDA. I was the aquaculture program coordinator there for a number of years, and then had the opportunity to go into the senior executive service and get involved in a lot of other aspects of agricultural research and even security issues as I went on in my career there. In about 2009, the administrator of the agency at that time had recognized the significant threat, potential threat, to food and agriculture from deliberate acts of terrorism. And I was quite interested in this myself. I had the opportunity, I said 2009, I'm sorry, 1999. I had the opportunity a year later to spend the better part of a year at the National Defense University as a research fellow, and I focused my research on agroterrorism. Did a lot of investigation at that time. Of course, this is before 9/11. And the more I read, the more I got into it, the more I realized, at least from the food and agriculture perspective, that we were exceedingly vulnerable for a lot of different reasons. I wrote a treatise about this, which was published by National Defense University, came out actually right after 9/11, essentially laying out a proposed approach that the federal government might take to better prepare against, respond to any potential acts directed against food and agriculture. And then I went on at USDA in the Agricultural Research Service to ultimately the acting director for Homeland Security before I retired in 2005. I then stayed very interested in this issue, needless to say, and began teaching at Georgetown. I teach in a master's program in biological threat agents and emerging infectious diseases in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the Medical Center. And I've been teaching that course to really bright, interested, challenging graduate students, you know, for the last, 7, 8, 9 years or whatever it is at this point. And, you know, and I say, and, you know, it's really true, I probably learn more from them than they do from me. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is because these students overwhelmingly go into positions related to national security. They don't go on to become medical doctors in almost all cases. They go on to positions either in federal agencies or in the private sector that, that help protect the country against, in this case, particularly biological threats. And so they really ask great questions. They have challenging exchanges. I bring in a lot of guest lectures. And the more I have done this, the more I have learned, the more convinced that I am that we are still exceedingly vulnerable on the food and agriculture side. And I'll pause there for a minute if you want to ask anything else, but I could go on a bit more about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we'll certainly work our way through that because I think that's something people don't think about. I mean, we have our listeners are incredibly well informed about what the different intelligence agencies do, you know, whether it's you know, even Department of Treasury and Department of Energy, these ones that are part of the intelligence community. Mm-hmm. But what a lot of people may not think about is the fact that the IC itself is not the only ones doing national security issues and things like the Department of Agriculture, right? Mm-hmm. What do you think? You know, we're going through the cabinet appointments for the new Trump administration. And people care a whole lot about who's going to run the DOD, who's going to run the State Department, but you don't think, oh, who cares who runs the Agriculture Department? Well, these are really key issues that could be, you know, whether cyber terrorism or nuclear weapons, but bioterrorism, something people don't think about all that much. And the USDA has a pretty major hand in this that I'm happy that you're here to talk about because it's something that I would like others to understand more than they probably do.
What we probably don't appreciate is that before 9/11, agriculture, food and agriculture, was not even recognized as a critical national infrastructure, which is astonishing to me because everybody's got to eat, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, agriculture, the food and agriculture system, makes up something like 1/6 of our economy, employs you know, about 1/6 of the employment force in both the upstream and downstream sides, the production, mm-hmm. processing, distribution, sale, retail, wholesale, export, and all that kind of stuff. It's a huge contributor to our economy. But it also inherently embodies a fear factor because there's nothing that probably scares people more than the worry about deliberate contamination of what they put into their mouths. And then by extension, of course, deliberate contamination of the things that, that go into the production, right, of the things that we put into our mouths.
Well, and this is nothing, I mean, people might think, well, that's a heavy lift for a terrorist, but biowarfare has been around for centuries. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people may know the story of plague victims being catapulted into castles under siege. And it's different armies depending on what source you read it from. It's either Alexander the Great or Genghis Khan or somebody. Yeah, yeah. But that's one of these basic things. And up until 1972, every developed country on Earth was building biological weapons that could kill millions and millions of people. Yeah. And I said 1972 because there was a treaty in 1972 that's supposed to ban bioweapons. Mm-hmm. But we know now that the Soviet Union never stopped, mm-hmm. That they continued on. And for anyone living in the D.C. area, I know this is a long-winded question, but I'm going to get there. Mm-hmm. Right up the street, you have U.S. AMRID, which is the U.S. Army's Medical Research Institute for Infectious Diseases, mm-hmm. which is working on some of these incredibly horrible diseases. Mm-hmm. My question from that is, based on everything we know in the past about biological weapons, mm-hmm. based on what U.S. AMRID is working on today, mm-hmm. there's no way that we can develop vaccines or cures for every possible bioweapon of the future.
Right. That's absolutely true. I'll give you an example from the agriculture side, and then we can mm-hmm. sort of segue into the broader issues of bioterrorism. But you know, what keeps people who are paying attention to the food and agriculture infrastructure, what keeps them awake at night probably more than anything else is the potential outbreak of foot and mouth disease in this country. And you know, that is a highly contagious disease. There are very few viruses that are more contagious than that. And we know from the UK outbreak in 2001 that it can spread through a country extraordinarily rapidly, and you know, even get well beyond what you might consider to be a containment zone before it's even detected. And so it's virtually impossible to stop once it's gotten out beyond a certain boundary area. There are something like, there are seven serotypes and over 60 subtypes of this particular virus. And we have been challenged extraordinarily in trying to come up with vaccines that would work across the board. They don't. You have to develop basically a different vaccine, certainly for every subtype. The other problem is these vaccines, once they're administered to an animal, are not distinguishable in the animal from the actual infection. And so that, you know, is an example of the challenges we have in general in coming up with effective vaccines against bioterrorism agents.
Is foot and mouth zoonotic? Is that the right word?
I think it's not zoonotic. All right. Zoonotic. I mean, it's, you know, I think there's been a case or two of a mild infection of a human. It doesn't kill the animal either. It just makes the animal unmarketable, makes it sick, makes it unappealing to the market.
What about genetically modified diseases, the chimeras?
That's the real concern, yeah. The real concern. So if we, you know, and you know, going back to what sort of triggered my thinking about writing this novel, is extrapolating that foot and mouth disease virus potential outbreak in the United States. And we've modeled this, and we know it would be horrendous if it broke out in this country. I mean, just huge societal issues, breakdown in social
order. Yeah, I really want to get into that, because that to me is one of the most interesting things.
It's very, very scary. Yeah. And, you know, we know, for example, that the only policy that's in place right now to deal with something like that is mass slaughter of animals. And if they had to slaughter 6 million livestock in England, it'd be many times that. This country would be required probably digging a ditch, according to one exercise scenario, 25 miles long, you know, to put all the carcasses in. So, you know, I got to thinking, all right, here's a very contagious viral disease that would certainly hammer our economy. It would cause social unrest, people watching, you know, mass funeral pyres of burning carcasses and that sort of thing. What if this was a zoonotic disease? What if it was a disease that was asymptomatic in animals, but could be transmissible to humans with potentially devastating consequences? And in fact, there are, you know, no shortage of zoonotic diseases out there. Something like 70% of the major diseases of humans are ultimately zoonotic.
And we went by this without defining it. Essentially, a zoonotic disease is something that can be transferred from an animal.
From an animal to a human. Yeah. That's correct, yeah.
Like anthrax, you know, like things like those. That's the one that people know, Zika and others like that too.
As you point out, even those that are vectored by insects.
Right. Because I would think that there are possibly two ways that a genetically modified disease could be very scary, and that would be taking a deadly disease that already is very bad and make it zoonotic, but also maybe taking a relatively benign zoonotic disease and making it deadly.
Yeah.
You know, kind of juicing up something that we can catch from animals that maybe just make us sick, but making it actually genetically modified to kill us.
Yeah. Sounds like you ought to write a novel.
Well, I read yours, so now I think I know stuff. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that is a huge concern, especially with the new gene editing technologies. And, you know, the concern that I have, and it's certainly not unique in my part, a lot of scientists have this concern, is that the science is leaps and bounds ahead of the public policy. And there are two components of that. One is that the science and the technology is moving so fast, and the other is that the public is woefully ignorant about what could happen, let alone, you know, what should be done about it. And so if you consider the potential for altering the genome with these new gene editing technologies of, as you say, you know, potentially benign pathogen, and making it highly infectious, making it, you know, lethal, then I don't know how we would contain it.
Yeah.
I really don't. And I don't know how long it will be before we come up with effective public policy that would, you know, keep this in check.
Yeah, sleep tight, kids. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I saw interesting as I was doing research for not only this but other things is that there are now people having conversations because of our knowledge of the DNA genome, knowledge of how different markers work for different ethnic groups, that you could potentially bioengineer a weapon that would only kill, let's say, Arabs or Asians or Caucasians, and release it to everybody. I mean, I'm thinking more of like the Stuxnet virus, which is the computer virus that infected every Siemens processor in the world, but only turned itself on when it had a very particular set of circumstances, and that happened to be an Iranian centrifuge. Hmm. It seems like, in what I've read, that that is not too far in the future where we could, I'm not saying the United States is going to do that, but somebody bad could genetically modify a virus to only attack certain ethnic groups or certain age groups or certain demographics. Mm-hmm. Is that something that is worrying people?
That is not something I've thought about.
Oh, sorry.
But, but I'm going to think about it now.
Yeah, sorry about that.
I think it's, you know, a terrifying prospect. And I could see that it, you know, could be scientifically achievable.
Well, yeah. let me flip this around. Can genetic modification actually be the solution to the problem? I saw that there are programming yeasts and bacteria that make medicines. I mean, I know that that's what they did to create insulin in the first place back decades ago.
Right.
But could you also do DNA modification to train the immune system to defend against foot and mouth disease?
Yeah, and I think, you know, with things like CRISPR-Cas9, you know, gene editing technology, it has tremendous potential for good, and could be used, you know, for applications such as what you suggested. I don't think there's any question about that. I think that's why the technology is going to move ahead so quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to be advanced and supported, including with federal funding, I'm sure, on the basis of, you know, the potential enormous biomedical benefits that can occur. But it's obviously a two-edged sword.
Yeah, you mentioned federal funding, and that was actually my next great segue. You talked about how the public is ignorant about this, and I assume that includes many members of Congress who don't have scientific background. I mean, we actually talk about this with cyber all the time, right? There are very few people in Congress understand how computers work, understand how cyber works. I bet even less understand bioweapons.
Yeah.
Is there the money from the federal government available to do the kind of necessary research, the kind of necessary preparations? It's more than just finding cures. It's preparing cities, it's preparing states, it's preparing people like FEMA and others to do a massive outbreak. Is there the proper national priority to bioweapons defense from your perspective?
Well, I think there are two aspects to an answer to that question. The first is, you know, the public support for the funding. And as you point out, as I mentioned, you know, the public is very, very ignorant of science in general, let alone some of these new scientific technologies that have the potential for both good and evil. And why is that? Well, there's a whole lot of reasons, not the least of which is the public has a very short attention span, and they like their information in short sound bites and so on. And in fact, I'm talking this afternoon at Georgetown about the responsibility and the opportunity of scientists to more effectively communicate to public audiences some of these issues. And not all scientists are, you know, comfortable with communicating, but most scientists are very good at communicating in writing, and many of them are good at communicating orally. But the problem has been that has not necessarily been perceived as part of their mission.
Right.
But we absolutely need to encourage scientists to communicate effectively and succinctly, but accurately, the science advancements that are taking place and their potential both for good and for nefarious purposes. So there is that. And so Congress ultimately needs to be the recipient of public, if not pressure, at least public encouragement to provide more funding for programs that not only allow us to develop the right kinds of technologies, but also to make sure that we develop the right kinds of policies to keep these technologies managed effectively. Now, the other half of the question is the money itself. And, you know, my experience has been with USDA, and I can say that absolutely it's been a challenge in USDA to get sufficient funding for the research that might be called counterterrorism research or biodefense research to protect food and agriculture. Very challenging because, you know, my agency, which is the research, the in-house research agency, the one that I worked for, the Agricultural Research Service, has a budget of about $1 billion, and that's a drop in the bucket
right.
compared to, say, NIH. And that covers a whole lot of different applications, everything from, you know, environmental research to production, plants, animals, nutrition, mm-hmm. et cetera. And so you sort of winnow that down and how much of it is going into biodefense, and it's not a lot.
Right.
And yet, that's where you're going to get the support for development of vaccines and biologicals, where you're going to get the support for better detection technologies, for monitoring, for surveillance, and for communication. And, you know, there's just not a lot of money there. Now, there is another whole part of USDA research, which is carried out by primarily the land-grant university system. Mm-hmm. But that research, even though a lot of it's funded by the federal government, is, you know, carried out at individual universities and not necessarily in partnership with the scientists at the Agricultural Research Service. But even adding that in, you're talking, what, a couple $1 billion or
right.
something like that. Now, NIH, and I don't, you know enough about the budgeting at NIH to be able to give you a good answer on that. But certainly, a lot of the research at NIH obviously is in support of the development of new everything from new therapies to disease prevention and so on. And I'm wondering, and I don't know the answer to this, you know, what sorts of conversations need to take place at the congressional level to help us not only identify priorities for funding for biodefense, but also to encourage better coordination across agencies.
That's a great, yeah.
Right? And also to ensure better accountability for the funds that are invested.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
So, a couple of days ago, former Department of Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge and former Senator Joe Lieberman wrote an op-ed for Time about biodefense, and it was not all that positive. And one of the real significant arguments I thought they made was that we still lack a centralized leadership to coordinate not only prevention and response, but also like how to plan this, how to coordinate this. Because as you show in the book, and as it would happen in real life, this would be an all hands on deck, you know, from FEMA to USDA to the military to intelligence agencies to, especially if it was bioterrorism, you'd have the FBI. And you look back at something, I'm thinking of a natural disaster, like the response to Deepwater Horizon, the oil spill, where there was 20 different agencies and nobody knew who was in charge, and it was a complete disaster. it seems like we're still in that same boat here. And they even said that in 2010, a report from a bipartisan commission on the proliferation of mass destruction had given the country an F grade, meaning A, B, C, D, F, for readiness against a bioterrorism attack. And that's problematic because it seems like the risk has only increased with weapons being now much easier to develop, with kind of DNA sequences and other things like that. And you've seen organizations like ISIS, mm-hmm. Trying to get their hands on biological weapons. Mm-hmm. Why aren't we getting our act together on this? I know that's a rhetorical question. Maybe it's way too big to answer. Yeah. But it seems like the evidence is there for us to start taking this seriously. I mean, I'll let you answer, sorry, again, James Stavridis, who is a former four-star admiral, NATO Supreme Allied Commander, who is somebody thrown around for being potentially in Trump's cabinet, says that the 21st century is going to be determined not by cybernetic threats, but by biological threats. Right. It seems like the right people are yelling very loudly. Yeah. What's it going to take for the people that matter to make a decision to do something about this?
Well, I'll answer from the perspective of my own experience, and it's not as negative as that. My assessment is not as negative as that.
That's good, thank God, because...
Yeah, well, I'll tell you pros and cons sort of from my point of view. You know, as I said, before 9/11, looking just the food and agriculture side, agriculture wasn't recognized as a critical national infrastructure. After 9/11, obviously there was a lot of scrambling, and the Department of Homeland Security was stood up, and we enacted a Homeland Security presidential directive that was specifically focused on food and agriculture. And the Department of Homeland Security has the overall coordination role, not only for bioterrorism in general, but for agricultural food protection of food and agriculture, even though the rubber hits the road at the agency, the USDA mm-hmm. itself. So there is that overall coordination role. Also, the number of different agencies that were sort of going off in their own directions before 9/11 have coalesced to a fairly effective degree. In addition, and this is a huge part of it, and I'm sure it's true of cyber terrorism as well, we can't forget the private sector. Mm. You know, the private sector is ultimately the responsible entity for protecting citizens,
right.
From products that they sell.
Right.
And the private sector and the federal agencies with regard to agro-terrorism were not communicating before 9/11. There are now mechanisms in place, there are programs in place, there are requirements in place that bring that coordination together. And it's been rocky. I bring in representatives from the private sector to talk to my class, and I always ask them, we won't quote you on it, but what do you think? How's it working with the federal government? And you get a diplomatic, but somewhat muted response about that. And it works well to some extent, but nowhere near as effective. And you can think of all the reasons why. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's everything from proprietary information, and if you're a Purdue Farms or right. Mars Corporation, you're not necessarily going to want to share what you're doing with the rest of the world. So there is all that, but I would say that we've made a lot of progress. There's one thing that I absolutely think we ought to be doing that we're not doing enough, from what I can tell, and that would apply across the board with bioterrorism, and that is to bring people from different entities, federal agencies, state agencies, first responders, private sector, together physically,
right,
and carry out some exercises. All right. I think it's really, really, really critical. And I've been involved in a couple of these. And, more than anything else, I really believe this. The most effective thing you can do in a rapid and effective response is to have people that know each other
right.
up front. You can pick up the phone. You can call the guy that's the sort of key person in the Department of Agriculture in the state of North Carolina and say, hey, Joe, we got this issue here. We think it might be a threat to, you know, and you'll know each other.
Right.
And that comfort level, that having worked together and having practiced, you know, responses to some scenarios, let alone how to prevent them in the first place, I think is incredibly effective.
Well, and something I thought found interesting in the book, actually, that I never thought about before, because I've thought about bioterrorism before. I've read a lot about development of biological weapons just because of my background. But things like, you need meteorologists to talk about wind patterns. So, you know, you have airborne viruses, you need to understand how they're going to spread. You need people who you wouldn't consider, you know, off the top of your head to be essential elements to any kind of defense against this.
Right.
And I didn't think of that. I can't imagine that an average person, especially a FEMA person or even a military person, is thinking, boy, we need to know which way the wind's going. And right. And certainly back in the 50s, they would have thought that because of fallout and everything else.
Yeah.
But that, to me, I was surprised. I'm like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. And that was something that was in your book that jumped out. I'm like, oh, a meteorologist.
And there are two other things that we need. We need social scientists, and I'll come to that in a second.
Yeah.
And we need people who know how to communicate and how to coach other people in how to communicate, because the message has to be clear and consistent and, to the extent possible, comforting. It can't be dishonest because people see right through it. But you've got to make sure that you get the word out accurately and that everybody is on the same page with the message, and that you've thought about this ahead of time and you have teams in place that can do that. But going back to the social scientist issue, or the social people who help manage the social aspects of something like an outbreak, I was the acting director of a horticultural research lab in Florida back in 2000, USDA ARS, Agricultural Research Service, and Florida was experiencing an outbreak of citrus canker, a devastating, you know, bacterial disease.
I was there.
Were you there?
Yeah.
All right.
My family's from Miami, so lost all our trees. Yeah.
Well, so here's the problem, all right? One of the scientists in our lab, an excellent, epidemiologist, plant epidemiologist, laid out a very strong foundation, scientific foundation, for an argument that the containment zone for the detection of a single case of citrus canker ought to be expanded from what I think it was a few hundred feet to 1,900 feet, all right? And that was then adopted by the state of Florida and APHIS, the USDA Animal Plant Health Inspection System, and that became the requirement. So if you had a single infected tree, then every citrus tree within 1,900 feet had to be destroyed.
Which was every tree in Florida, essentially.
Well, there's a lot of trees, but it started out, Broward County, Miami, that area. But what was not recognized or appreciated at the time was that a lot of citrus trees in Broward County and Miami are sort of heirloom family trees that are planted in the backyards of homeowners, in many cases in honor of somebody in their family who had died. And so all of a sudden you then had the federal government coming in saying, we're cutting your tree down, you know? And there had been no adequate rollout of communications ahead of time. And as a result of that, it was challenged in court, and a judge in Broward County basically called a halt to the tree destruction program because of the public outcry. And in part because of that, and there were other factors, citrus canker was not contained and spread throughout Florida. Yeah. Now they got issues with another disease now, sort of screening. But, you know, and that's a very good example, it seems to me, of if you don't get the social part of it right up front and don't communicate effectively and get people on board. And you can't do this as soon as a disease breaks out. You got to be thinking about it ahead of time. And that goes back to the exercise.
Yeah, and that's the most chilling part of your book. And I think that when people read it, they'll understand this as well, is while a biological attack would be bad when it comes to people who have died, the social disruption would be potentially far worse. And I think that when the, you know, at 3 a.m. when there's lights on at the Pentagon, when there's the people who are thinking about WMDs aren't necessarily thinking about how many thousands are going to die. They're thinking about what they'd have to do after an outbreak. And that's everything from containment, you know, where you bring in the National Guard, to ask citizen soldiers to shoot people who are leaving certain areas. Mm-hmm. But it's also things like medical services. You know, doctors and nurses are not immune to these diseases. And if you're a smart bioterrorist, and I hope you thought about this already, bioterrorist, and I'm not giving you ideas, the doctors and the nurses would be your first target. And then the ideas of martial law. And in the book, you show that the communication was a real problem. Thinking about how to maintain societal norms and societal systems could be the real problem here.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the scenarios in my book is that you have this sort of buffer zone around the initial containment zone where you depopulate. And that's not far-fetched. That was done not for people, but for livestock in Holland. When the UK outbreak occurred in 2001, so it did spread over to the continent, the Netherlands did set up a sort of a perimeter zone, which they basically, you know, depopulated. Well, they also, you know, vaccinated with a vaccine that was available at the time, even though it couldn't, you know, the presence of the vaccine itself did not allow people to distinguish between whether the animal had been exposed
right.
to foot and mouth or whether it was the vaccine, but they weren't concerned about that to the degree that we are because of our export market, you know. And so that idea of an outer perimeter of whatever you do with it, depopulation, or if you have a good vaccine, fine, you know, is important. But we don't have that, you know, for something that potentially has no vaccine, no effective antidotes, and
yeah.
we have to respond to in a hurry. So I think we...
Well, and your book takes place in a relatively rural area. I can only imagine trying to run this in a city, where you would have to displace a million people, perhaps, and the kind of social unrest that would be the result of that, where hospitals are overwhelmed, where medical workers would be sick, and then it's near impossible, you would think, to be able to get new supplies within these infected areas.
Yeah. Or food,
yeah. And the U.S. military is not designed to police its own people and to, I mean, I'm ex-Army. I spent many years thinking, you know, about killing other people, but I can't imagine if I was sent to Miami and told that if a bus of school kids tries to run the roadblock, I have to shoot with them a tank. Mm-hmm. I might hesitate, or if I did it, I would be gone forever.
Well, and that's another issue. Yeah. I mean, it's posse comitatus. You
know,
you can't, I mean, maybe you could use the National Guard. Yeah, you should be able to use the National Guard, but the active duty military, you couldn't. And yet the National Guard resources are, you know, relatively small compared to the active duty military. But those are huge questions, but they're important questions because one way or another, we've got to be able to contain something like that as quickly as possible.
And it's much better to ask these questions now than it is when you start to think that you have an outbreak.
It is, yeah.
Well, and my last kind of focus is on something you mentioned before. It's kind of the fear of this, and you talked about the fear out there. And I'm thinking back to the anthrax scare after 9/11, where if you don't know, anthrax envelopes with anthrax were sent to members of the press and several congressional offices. And immediately people blamed Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
Immediately people were looking for countries to bomb. It was Iraq.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be a disgruntled, well, we think, who knows at this point still, turned out to be a disgruntled U.S. Bioweapons researcher.
Yeah.
But the fear that created was extraordinary.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I think it's something just people don't understand it.
Yeah.
Anything you don't understand, you're going to be terrified of.
Yeah.
And, you know, and people have had 70 plus years to understand nuclear weapons a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
But bioweapons are something new to everyone.
Yeah. Yeah.
And since you can't see it and you don't know a lot about it, the fear to me seems to be the overriding factor of what could be a real problem.
And that's the whole issue of terror, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and the unpredictability, and the fact, you know, that with biological agents, it may be a matter of days before symptoms show up, let alone before you can determine what it is that's causing the person to be sick. And, you know, just that uncertainty on the part of people, you know, I can't imagine anything that would be more terrifying than that, you know. I mean, it's, you know, certainly bad enough to go to a public place and worry about somebody blowing themselves up or something. But that's not a contagious sort of thing, you know. Biological agent is.
Well, Hank, thanks for scaring the hell out of us. Hank Parker is the author of the new novel Containment, a bioterrorism thriller, which is out now. If you have any interest in this quite extraordinary field, this is a really good entry point. I think that there's just enough science that it's realistic. There's just enough science that it kind of leads you to start thinking in certain directions. But I think it's completely accessible to anyone as just a great thriller. And it might give you some ideas about where to go next. And I think I enjoyed it very much. Again, we don't have a lot of novelists on here, but I felt that this was important to have this conversation with you. So, Hank, thank you for taking the time to talk to us here on SpyCast.
Well, thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to SpyCast. Remember, every Tuesday we will post a new podcast available from both spymuseum.org and iTunes. If you have any questions or comments about SpyCast, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org or leave a comment or review on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @INTLSpycast. That's INTLSpycast. Talk to you next week.